It's been several weeks since I've given you any scientific discoveries, and I was kind of anxious to get through this Bible study, but we had two happen this past week that you've got to hear about. And one is the first ever recovery of nuclear DNA from Neanderthals. They've been finding in 12 different specimens mitochondrial DNA, but this past week they announced the first ever recovery of nuclear DNA. Now, we're talking that part of the DNA that does not recombine. I mean, it's really not helpful to recover DNA that does recombine. You want to either work with the Y chromosome, which is nuclear DNA that only men would have, and therefore, in the intercourse, there's no contribution from the woman for that part of the DNA. And likewise, mitochondrial DNA has been helpful because we all get that from our mothers. And therefore, what you're able to do is to trace the history of the change in the DNA through the female line with mitochondrial DNA, or through the Y chromosome through the male side with that the Y chromosome DNA. Now, the disadvantage with mitochondrial DNA is that there are a few individuals in the population that get double copies of mitochondrial DNA. That's referred to in the scientific literature as heteroplasmy. And about 1 out of 10 people get double copies. And then 1% gets triple copies. They call that triplasmy. And so when you read in the newspapers how they dated the first woman to have existed on the Earth 150,000 years ago, keep in mind that that's an assumption based on the lack of heteroplasmy and the lack of triplasmy. If you take into account the heteroplasmy and the triplasmy, you approximately divide that date by 3. And so you come up with a date of 50,000 years for the first woman, which is roughly consistent with the date that you get through Y chromosome analysis. Now, the most accurate date we've got for the origin of humanity is through an analysis of Y chromosomes for humans. And the date we have now is between 46,000 and 54,000 years ago. So it's known with plus or minus 4,000 year accuracy. Whereas with mitochondrial DNA, the accuracy is no better than plus or minus 50%. So recovering a Y chromosome DNA portion from a Neanderthal is big news, because now we can actually do the same kind of study we've been doing on humans and do it on Neanderthals. And the other advantage is because there's no heteroplasmy or triplasmy with the nuclear DNA, you're able to get a much cleaner record of the change in the DNA. So as with mitochondrial DNA, it's a challenge to try to determine how much evolution has taken place in that mitochondrial DNA. You get a much cleaner record with the Y chromosome. Now, as it is, on the mitochondrial side, we see so little differentiation amongst the 12 Neanderthal specimens we have that we're able to confidently conclude that Neanderthal's DNA suffered no significant change, which means a Neanderthal species did not evolve. And that's a serious challenge to the evolutionary paradigm, because their whole hypothesis is that, you know, chimpanzees, the great apes and humans, and Neanderthals and Australopithecines and Homo erectus all had a common ancestor, and that the DNA evolved over time to produce all these different species. While that scenario is really accurate, we would expect to see significant change within each species over a long period of time. And Neanderthals were here from 150,000 years ago to 30,000 years ago. So it's 120,000 years. And the fact that we can't record any significant change in the mitochondrial DNA is a serious restraint on any naturalistic interpretation for human origins. But now that they've got the nuclear DNA, they're going to be able to do that kind of test with much more precision. And therefore, we're already on record as predicting that when additional nuclear DNA samples are recovered from Neanderthals, it will give us even stronger evidence that Neanderthals have not evolved. And we're fairly confident about that prediction, because we already have Y chromosomes from quite a number of humans over the past 40,000 years. And when you look at human Y chromosome DNA, we see very little differentiation over that time period, which shows that the human species has not experienced any significant evolution over the past 40,000 years. And so we would expect that we would see the same result coming when we look at the Neanderthal DNA. Yes. they can't. I mean, they're basically saying, well, what they have done so far, and they're still analyzing the DNA, they basically announced to the scientific community, we've been able to recover enough of the Y chromosome that we can do significant comparisons. And they've already done a rough check with that part of the Y DNA chromosome that they've recovered with this similar stretch of the chimpanzee Y DNA and the human Y DNA. And what they have announced in Nature as well as in Science is that the differences are enormous, which immediately throws into question the idea that these species could have had a common ancestor. If they had a common ancestor, the DNA should be much more similar, and it's not. Yeah. Neanderthals range was all over Europe and into Asia as far as the Caucasus. So, basically Europe and a little bit of West Asia. We have not recovered any out of Africa at all. So it's just that one range. And again, the time range is 150,000 to about 30,000 years ago. So... But by the way, with this new technique they've got for analyzing Y chromosome, they're coming up with like a million base pairs. And with mitochondrial DNA, they've been able to come up with maybe 1,100. So they're going to be able to compare a much larger portion of the DNA. In fact, there was some talk in the article they might be able to recover the entire genome of the Neanderthal, which that'll take a long time, but that's actually doable. Now, that's how they get the DNA. The thing about nuclear DNA is it decays rapidly. So if you ever saw that movie Jurassic Park where they're recovering DNA of dinosaurs through, mosquito blood, that's preposterous because there's no way that stuff could stay pristine enough that you could recover anything meaningful. How they're able to do it with Neanderthals, and for that matter ancient humans, is they look for Neanderthal specimens where there's been rapid burial and where the bones remain intact, so that you've got a sealed bone. And then what they do is they crack open one of the bones and they recover the DNA that's in the marrow of the bone. And the whole point there is if the bone is sealed, if there's rapid burial and the bone becomes sealed, then oxygen doesn't get into that. It's the oxygen that rapidly degrades the DNA. So if you're lucky enough to find a specimen where there's been rapid burial and none of the bones have been broken, then you can recover the DNA and actually see what's going on there. So this is a wait-and-see thing. I mean, what they know so far is it's very different from the chimp DNA and very different from human DNA. But we're predicting that this is going to give us further evidence that these hominids and the humans really don't experience any evolution. All of them must be special creations by the hand of the creator God of the Bible. Some additional evidence is coming through is that they now have recovered fossils of Homo erectus. And a significant point there is now that they've got the DNA evidence that shows that Neanderthals and humans were never related, they're now claiming that both evolved from Homo erectus. And with Homo erectus, it's so ancient we can't get any DNA. Once it gets past a little more than 100,000 years, even if the bone is sealed, the DNA will not be pristine enough that it'll tell you anything meaningful. And with Homo erectus, their time range is 200,000 years ago to 1.8 million years ago. And therefore, all of the Homo erecti specimens are simply too old to come up with any DNA recovery. Although there are a few anthropologists that believe that Homo erectus may have survived as late as 100,000 years ago. It's just that we don't have any specimens yet that date in that range, or at least unambiguously date in that range. So there is a little vestige of hope that we might be able to find a recent enough Homo erectus so we can get some DNA. But what we have with Homo erectus is dozens of specimens over that whole time range. And as you look at the skeletons of these creatures, the ones that are 200,000 years old are identical to the ones that are 1.8 million years old. So at least in terms of the bone structure, it shows you that over 1.6 million years, no evolution. And if none of these creatures are evolving, then how can they possibly be related in an evolutionary manner? Okay, let me switch gears and talk to you a little bit about planets. This was announced just a couple of days ago. in the British journal Nature. They have now found a planetary system where you've got a star orbited by what they call three Neptunes. And let me just get the data here for you. Yeah, here it is. Okay, three planets orbiting the star. They've not found any Jupiters or Saturns, only planets of the approximate mass of Neptune. And one comes in at greater than 10 Earth masses, greater than 12, and greater than 18. These are simply lower limits. In fact, there's been some speculation that maybe this planetary system is oriented almost in our line of sight, and these possibly could be planets as big as Saturn and Jupiter. We just know they can't be any less massive than 10, 12, and 18 Earth masses. Because what's happening here is they're trying to pick up the dynamics of these planets by looking at how the gravity of the planet affects the motion of the star. So, for example, if you've got a star here and a planet orbiting that star, in your line of sight, when the planet is here, its gravity is going to pull the star towards you. And the spectral lines will actually show you that star's light shifting towards the red or the blue. It would be blue on this side. As the planet goes this way, it would pull it away, and that would become red. And that's how they figure out the masses. And, you know, if it's exactly in your line of sight, then the masses are 10, 12, and 18. But if the system is tilted a little bit, then you'll be getting an underestimate of the masses, because you're not going to get as strong a pull in your particular direction. And if it's oriented this way, the masses literally could be infinite. So it all depends on the tilt angle here. But the assumption here is that indeed we're looking at it in the line of sight, and therefore the masses are as small as 10, 12, and 18. And this is what generated a lot of the excitement. We're now finding planets almost as small as the Earth. Well, not quite. But what really generated the excitement is that one of these Neptunes is what's called in the life habitable zone. Now, you're going to hear a lot about that in the announcements. In fact, I heard that announced in the radio, that they had now found a small planet like Earth in the life zone. And naturally gets people all excited that maybe this is a planet that could have life on it. The problem here is that what's called the habitable zone is simply any region where there's a possibility that liquid water could exist. And that zone, if it was our solar system, would range from Venus out to about Mars. And you say, well, liquid water only exists on Earth. It doesn't exist on Venus and Mars. Well, what these scientists do is they fiddle with the atmosphere in order to, in other words, if you put a really thick atmosphere around Mars so it has a powerful greenhouse effect, then you would have the temperature zone whereby liquid water could exist. And if you make Mars big enough where its gravity doesn't lose that water, everything works out fine. But that's the assumption. You have to assume that you've got a planet of the just right mass with the atmosphere that's going to trap just the right amount of heat. Now, planet Earth here is about 30 degrees warmer than it otherwise would be because of its greenhouse effect. So what you could do is take planet Earth and strip it of most of its atmosphere, then you could bring the Earth a lot closer to the sun and have liquid water there. Question? Well, that's another whole problem. Without a strong magnetic field, if you got a planet, see, all three of these Neptunes are close to their star. Close enough to the star that radiation from the star will sputter away the atmosphere unless you've got a magnetic field to protect that planet from the solar radiation. And so, for example, you look at Mars, a lot of its atmosphere has been sputtered away by the radiation from the sun. That doesn't happen to Earth because of our strong magnetic field. And that's a challenge because the magnetic field's got to stay there. It's not that difficult for a planet like Mars to have a temporary magnetic field. In fact, there are some studies that tells us that when Mars was very young, for a brief period of time, it had a magnetic field. But it won't stay unless you have this core that's super fine-tuned. You basically need a solid inner core surrounded by a liquid core that's enriched with just the right amount of elements. And that happened to planet Earth. It didn't happen to Venus or to Mars or to any other planet for that matter, because planet Earth received a collision from a Mars-sized body when it was only 30 to 50 million years old, and also received a second enrichment of fine-tuned heavy elements at the late heavy bombardment. And therefore, in that sense, when you talk about habitable planets, we need to realize you have to have a lot more than just the right temperature for liquid water. So that's all that these, when you hear these public announcements, when they say life habitable zone, they simply mean a planet with the temperature where liquid water could possibly survive. But as this young man mentioned, you know, you've got to have a magnetic field too, or the water you have is going to leave, and that's not going to be nice for life if the water leaves. And then what we also note is these planets all have very high eccentricities. And what an eccentricity means is the ellipticity of the orbits. So if you've got a star here, all orbits around stars are elliptical. But the nice thing about planet Earth is the ellipticity of its orbit is really slight. It's only about 1%. And therefore, our planet is not that much farther away in the far part of its orbit than it is in the near part. In both cases, it stays within that temperature zone where liquid water could remain. But if you have an ellipticity of 5% or greater, then that means at certain points in the orbit, that planet's going to go outside the place where liquid water can remain stable. So with a high ellipticity, the water that you do collect would rapidly leave. And that's the thing we've noticed about the 200 planets we've discovered outside the solar system. Either they are too elliptical in their orbital shape, or the planet is orbiting too close to its star. And that's the other thing I noticed in this paper here, is that they've got one planet orbiting a little bit closer to its star than Venus. And you say, well, Venus is too hot to have liquid water on it. But what makes this, quote, the habitable zone for this particular system is the star is only 89% the mass of the sun. And so it's much dimmer. And you say 11% isn't a big deal, but the luminosity of a star goes up with a fourth power of its mass. So an 11% difference is huge. So this star is a lot dimmer than the sun, which means you can place the planet a lot closer and still put it in that liquid water zone. But there's a big catch. The closer you bring a planet to its star, the more powerful the tidal interaction. The tidal interaction goes up with the inverse of the fourth power, the distance between the planet and the star. So, for example, if we were to move planet Earth even 2% closer to the sun, it would now be close enough where it would become tidally locked. You say, what's tidal locking? That's where Earth would go around the sun once every day. It would rotate in 365 days and revolve in 365 days. The moon, for example, is tidally locked to the Earth. The reason why you see the same face of the moon every time you look at it is because it's tidally locked. The moon takes 29 days to revolve around the Earth. It also takes 29 days to rotate on its axis. And that's simply because of the fact that the gravity of the Earth pulls more powerfully on one side of the moon than it does the opposite side of the moon. So if you've got a lump on one side of the moon, what's going to happen is that the gravitational pull of the Earth will work to force that lump to face towards the Earth. And thereafter, it's going to have the same side. Well, Venus and Mercury are tidally locked to the sun. The same face faces the sun as they go orbiting around. And in all three cases with these planets, all three of them must be tidally locked. And if they're tidally locked, what that means is it's going to be extremely hot on half of the face of the planet and extremely cold on the opposite side, which means you don't have an environment for stable liquid water. You know, some have argued maybe you can get stable liquid water right on the edges, but that doesn't work either because no planet has a perfect tidal locking. It wobbles a little bit. The moon wobbles, for example, by about 5 degrees. So it means even if you're right on the edge, you're going to get enough exposure with that tidal locking to make it far too hot for the liquid water to stay, or far too cold for it not to remain in the frozen state. So in that sense, this is false advertising. This is really not a possible example of a planet, never mind the fact that it's way too big. Coming in at 18 solar masses, it's going to hold an atmosphere, which means that it's not going to be appropriate for life. I mean, Neptune, for example, these are planets roughly the size of Neptune. or bigger, and a Neptune's big enough that it retains lots of ammonia and methane in its atmosphere. Earth's gravity is not strong enough to keep those kinds of gases. These other planets are. Frankly, I think what's really going on here is that these are probably slightly bigger planets than what they've recorded here, and they've drifted in. In other words, they formed far away, and then they drifted in towards the central part of the star system. Let me tell you the bottom line to all this. We've now found 200 planets outside of our solar system. Before 1995, the only planets we knew of were planets in our own solar system. Now we've found 200 outside our solar system. Before 1995, we had astronomers predicting that once we find planets outside the solar system, we're going to discover that they're planets just like those that orbit around our solar system. That prediction has proven to be false. We have yet to find any analog to our solar system that would permit even the most primitive life form to exist. All 200 planets are non-candidates for life, but not only non-candidates for life, they're non-candidates for even the possibility of a planet like Earth existing in the system. In other words, you could take these three Neptunes, there's no way you could put a small planet in that system and have it support life, because these three Neptunes are so close to the star, it would disturb the orbit of any planet that could possibly support life. And that's true of all 200 of these systems. Now, the planets that they contain rule out the possibility of a small planet that could possibly have life on it. Yes. Well, some have speculated that maybe you can't have life on the surface. Maybe you could have life below the surface. You know, like Europa, for example, is still being speculated as a possible site where life could exist. That if you were to drill down through the ice on Europa to the possibly existing liquid water ocean below, you might find bacteria there. That's been speculated, as well as the idea that maybe in the upper atmosphere of Venus, you could have floating bacterial life. There are good reasons why both of those hypotheses cannot be correct. The ice on Europa is too thick. And the problem with thick ice is that although you might have life in the ocean below, that life is going to require a source of oxidants. And the oxidants would be on the surface. And the ice is too thick, the oxidants aren't going to be able to get through that ice down to where they're needed by the life below. So in that sense, we can save NASA a lot of money. They don't have to drill through Europa's ice to send a little explorer looking around for bacteria. We already know there's no oxidants that can get down there, and there's no oxidants that can get down there. There's no possibility for life to survive there. That's one way you can challenge it. A second way you can challenge it is say, okay, let's consider the chemical environment that exists under the ocean. Would that chemical environment allow for the origin of life? And the answer is no, it won't. We already know it lacks the chemicals that would be necessary. So for two reasons we know, it's going to be a fruitless search. I'd still be interested in drilling through the ice because it'd be kind of fun to figure out what's underneath there. And by the way, NASA's been talking a lot about the fact that there's liquid water under the Europa ice. We don't know that for sure. It could well be that it's slush rather than liquid water, and it could be frozen all the way down. The only way it will be liquid water is if indeed there's enough tidal friction between Europa and Jupiter to heat the water below the ice. But we won't know that for sure until we put a satellite in orbit around Europa. A satellite in orbit around Europa will tell us how much tidal friction exists between Europa and Jupiter. By the way, that experiment can be done for only a few million dollars. The experiment to drill a hole through the Europa ice and put a probe down there that will video record bacteria, that's been put at $2.5 billion. And frankly, I think that's no way. It's going to be more money than that. But the whole point is you spend a few million, put this thing around Europa, and if you discover the tidal friction is so small that the ice is frozen all the way through, you can save the taxpayer $2.5 billion plus. And the whole, by the way, this is a lot of the content that's going in my new book, Creation of Science. One way to test different worldviews, a Christian worldview against a naturalistic worldview, is to determine which one is most efficient at producing scientific results. So this is just an example. a Christian worldview perspective would say, well, how many places does God really need life? Well, it looks like from a biblical perspective, he can get by with one. Not that he has to have just one, but he could get by with one. And therefore, we should be a little bit circumspect about speculating that there's got to be life in the ocean below Europa. Let's first find out if there's an ocean there. If there's no ocean there, that kind of settles things. Yes. Yes. In fact, oxygen is really quite toxic to life. If you listen to the nutritionists, they're always telling you to make sure you take in plenty of antioxidants into your diet. They talk about the origin of life research, these extremophiles, extreme life forms that don't need oxygen. And there are some. They call them chemoautotrophs rather than photoautotrophs. And there are things that will feed on methane, for example, and they can get by without oxygen. Now, what oxygen does for you, though, is allow for a high metabolic rate, and it also allows for a large body size. So without oxygen, it's got to be a microorganism with a relatively low metabolic rate. And evidently, the Creator wanted us to be able to do some significant things. It required a large body size and a high metabolic rate, which meant we had to breathe oxygen, but it also meant that God had to design creatures to deal with oxygen poisoning. And so if you look at the human biochemical system, it's loaded with all of these molecules that are designed to protect us from oxygen poisoning. So in that sense, some scientists have said, we are the extremophiles. We're able to live in an oxygen-rich environment, which would normally be deadly to biochemistry. In fact, that's one reason why we know that the origin of life could not have occurred on planet Earth under naturalistic conditions, because we already have firm evidence that oxygen was present on the early Earth. And if oxygen is present on the early Earth, there's no way that these chemicals can self-assemble into proteins, DNA, and RNA. It just can't happen, because oxygen is simply toxic to origin of life chemistry. But it's also toxic to all of us. So do eat your green vegetables. That will help your biochemical systems to defend itself against the breakdown from the oxygen poisoning. Right here. Europa, I don't forget its exact size, but it's roughly comparable to the size of our moon. Jupiter has four moons going around it, two that are bigger than our moon and two that are slightly smaller. And I just forget exactly where Europa fits in there. But it's close to the size of our moon. Okay, yes. It is hard to detect an Earth-sized planet. It's much easier by this one method I talked about to pick up the Jupiters. And what's happening is the technique is now accurate enough that it can pick up Saturns and Neptunes. And it's getting close to the point of being able to pick up Earths. So, for example, this paper, this is basically a paper giving results from the application of a brand new technique to make this more precise. And they're saying, we've proved it's precise because we picked up three Neptunes in one system. But they also point out in this paper that if the planet orbits close enough to its star, they could pick up an Earth-sized planet. Yeah, this is a new technique. So what this is going to mean is we should be, I would guess within 2 years we'll have over 1,000 planets discovered outside of our solar system by this method because of this increased precision. It's going to revolutionize the whole field. Now, finding a planet orbiting close to its star does not mean that's a planet that's a candidate for life, because it'd be just so close it'd either be very hot or it would be tidally locked. So it'd be hot on one side and cold on the other side, just like Mercury is. And being so close to its star, it's going to suffer a lot more atmospheric sputtering. So just like Mercury has had its atmosphere sputtered away by being too close to the sun, that would happen too. However, there is a current technique where they really can find true Earth analogs. And that's to look for transits. So, for example, if you get a star here and a planet like Earth orbiting that star, and it orbits very close to your line of sight, that means every time it goes around, it will block out some of the light of the star. And we have techniques that allow us to measure the luminosity to the star to many places of the decimal. And it's sensitive enough that if a planet like Earth were to cross in front of the star, we would know it. Now, what's really cool about that is you actually find out the diameter of the planet. So, because you can measure the way the light dims and how it comes out of the limb phase and so forth. And that will tell you. So, there's a huge program underway to look for transiting Earths. And then there's a third technique. This third technique is to use gravitational lenses to actually image the star. And that will work if you look, say, towards a place where there's lots of stars. So if you look towards the center of our galaxy, for example, you have the opportunity of finding, say there's a planet here, and you get a star here and a star here, then you get a double gravitational lens. Because general relativity tells us that a massive body will bend light. And so if you put that massive body directly between the astronomer's telescope and the object he's trying to image, then that intervening massive body will act as an optical lens. It will bend the light in such a way, and you can get a magnification factor of over 100. If you get two stars oriented so you get a double lens, you get a powerful magnification, and with that you can actually see the light of the planet. So that's another technique. And then they've got a fourth technique, which is the brute force method, which is to put a bunch of telescopes into orbit around the solar system and hook them up like an interferometer and use those telescopes to directly image planets all over a galaxy. And that will allow you to measure the mass of the planet, the size of the planet, and you can even analyze the chemistry of its atmosphere. So that will really tell you everything you want to know. It's proposed. It's the most expensive way to detect Earth-sized planets. I mean, the cheap way is to look for these lucky gravitational lenses, and then the transits are a fairly cheap way of doing it. The most expensive way is the brute force method, but it's also going to be by far the most productive. I see very little hope of it not getting funded. There's such a drive within NASA to try to find life elsewhere in our galaxy. It's like, you know, this is the one that will really prove it one way or the other. So, and I'm excited about it because it's going to give us data about these planets we can't get any other way. So, and it's not that big of an expenditure. I think $1 billion, they'll have the whole thing in operation. So what's $1 billion amongst friends, right? Hyperbaric chambers, what was your question? Okay, what I think you're talking about is where they push the pressure of the oxygen up. Hyperbaric chambers are a good therapeutic technique if you've got wounds on your body where you've got poor circulation. And so those are parts of your body that are not getting the oxygen they normally would through good circulation. And so you might put your limb or your elbow, for example, in a hyperbaric chamber. And then what you're doing is you're forcing external oxygen at high pressure into that wound to bring healing. Remember, we were talking earlier how oxygen is toxic? Well, it's toxic for lots of bad stuff, too. So if you want to deal with an infection and you can get oxygen in there, that will help. Oh, you mean these oxygen bars? Oh, I know what you mean. You go into a chamber and they have high-pressure oxygen in there and it makes you feel really good. Well, long-term, it's bad for you. Short-term, it makes you feel good. So it's kind of like taking a drug. I mean, it'll make you feel good for a short period of time. But what you're doing is you're speeding up the metabolic rate. And therefore, you're also speeding up the rate of damage that takes place. So, I mean, she may look good for a while, but if she keeps doing that, she will discover premature aging will set in. And it's not good for your circulatory system either. And this is well known because of the fact that jet fighter pilots in the 50s, We're breathing 100% pure oxygen in their cockpits. And those jet fighter pilots, at least those that had lots of flight hours, they were dying by the age of 50 or less. Basically, their bodies wore out too quickly from that oxygen exposure. So oxygen is good to maintain a high level of metabolism, but too much oxygen is a bad thing. And if you want to live a lot longer, just don't breathe a lot of oxygen. That'll help you. But you won't be able to do very much either. Yeah, you could live on top of the mountains, only the problem with living on top of the mountains, there is less oxygen. It will lower your metabolic rate. However, you do expose yourself to more cosmic radiation. So, yeah, there's really, in fact, I'll just divert a little bit, then we'll get back into our Bible study. Years ago, I was part of this little think tank where we were trying to figure out where can we go where we could really significantly enhance the lifespans of the human beings. And the problem is that if you go up to high altitude, you get more cosmic rays, which shortens your lifespan. People in Denver, for example, live 3 months less on the average than people in Los Angeles because of the fact they're at high elevation. And so, you know, living in L.A. does have its advantages, okay? But smog is good. I'd say this, smog is good for you in one context because it reduces how much ultraviolet radiation you can get through. It means you won't get quite as much damage on your skin. Now, you say, okay, let's get away from the cosmic rays. Well, an easy way to get rid of the cosmic rays is go underground. If you live underground, you will get rid of a lot of the cosmic rays. The problem is the Earth's crust is filled with uranium and thorium. And for example, people who mine coal, they don't live that long because of the fact that coal is loaded with uranium and thorium. And by the way, you actually release more radiation in the environment when you burn coal than when you fission uranium. And so it's actually safer in terms of radiation exposure to be getting your energy from uranium fission than it is from burning coal. A lot of people don't know that. Coal is loaded with uranium and thorium. But the deeper you go into the Earth's crust, the more exposure you receive from the radiation that's in the Earth's crust. So in that sense, the people in Denver have an advantage because they don't get as heavily exposed to that stuff as we do here. And by the way, Moscow is a bad place to live because Moscow is filled with all these granite buildings. Stalin loved granite, so he had all these skyscrapers all over Moscow made out of granite. But granite's loaded with uranium and thorium. And so that makes things unpleasant. Now, what we did discover is there's one way to really get rid of the radiation exposure, and that's to live inside a salt mine. Because if you're in a nice thick bed of salt, and you're in the middle of that salt deposit, that will protect you from the uranium and the thorium, and if it's deep enough underground, you'll be protected from the cosmic rays. But then we asked ourselves the question, is there such a salt deposit in the crust of the Earth? And as far as we know, we were not able to find one that was big enough and thick enough where we could actually carve out a cavity and have people live there. And then there's a psychological problem. Who would want to spend all their life living in the middle of a salt deposit? So in that sense, there's really no easy way you can have your lifespan extended beyond 120 years. Yeah, you could do that. You could live in the ocean. So, but you got to be careful because if you were to live, say, in a bubble on the seafloor, that's not going to help. Because the basalts in the seafloor actually have a higher amount of uranium and thorium in it than the stuff on the continental land masses. And so you'd want to be floating in a nice deep spot, not too far from the bottom, not too far from the top. And again, who would want to live in such an environment? So the psychological issues are there. And actually, this had a biblical application, trying to explain how people living in the days before Noah could live as long as they did. And the answer is, they could not have been exposed to cosmic radiation like we are. And that's why I've written in our books that astronomers have now discovered that there is a supernova eruption that took place at the time of Noah that significantly increased the cosmic ray exposure of human species. So people living before Noah wouldn't be exposed to the deadly cosmic rays that we're being exposed to. And by the way, this thing's quite close, because the remnant left over from the supernova eruption measures 40 degrees across the sky. That's how we're able to determine it exploded roughly at the time of Noah's flood. However, there's another problem. We would also have to guarantee that the people living before the flood were not being exposed to uranium and thorium, which means that they would have to live in a place that has sedimentary rocks. But that's what you see in Mesopotamia. That's one reason why we think humanity was limited to Mesopotamia, because it's really the only way people could live a long time. They were living in a place where they were being exposed to granite or to igneous rocks. That would shorten their lifespan. If they're living in a place where there's no igneous rocks around, they would be fine. But it also means that they could not have been exploiting concrete or granite as building materials. And that's the problem today. No matter where you go on planet Earth, you are exposed to igneous rocks. There's concrete everywhere. So there's nowhere you can go to escape that situation. And by the way, you'd also have to dramatically change your biochemistry. We believe, Buzz Ron and I believe in our book, Who is Adam, that God altered the biochemistry at the time of Noah. Before Noah, we had a biochemistry that allowed us to optimally function with 900-year lifespans. We now have a biochemistry that allows us to optimally function with 120-year lifespans or less. And if we had the biochemistry of the people before Noah, we'd be dying rapid deaths from cancer. Because of the radiation exposure, it's necessary that our biochemistry guarantee that we not live past 120 years. If it didn't, then we'd be dying at age 30 and 40 from cancer. As it is, some of us could make it into our 70s and 80s without being wiped out by cancer. Yes. Well, there are things you can do to lengthen your lifespan close to the 120-year maximum. I would say avoiding meat isn't going to be significant, although a lot of people think that's the way to live a long time. It really doesn't make that much difference. What does make a difference is having a low metabolic rate. And so, yeah, if you're a monk that doesn't talk and doesn't do anything and just breathes shallow breaths, that will help. But you've got to have the right kind of diet, too. You want a diet that's loaded in antioxidants and doesn't have too much oxidants. You want to avoid carcinogens. Bottom line is you're not going to have a lot of fun. So you're a monk, you're not having fun anyway. Okay, that's a good point. Yeah. Okay, well, I'll let you interrupt. I'm going to shift gears and get into our Bible lesson here. Let me pull this up here. You know, okay. All right. Well, it's healthy if you're trying to get yourself out of bed in the morning so that you can start doing things. So if you've got a really low blood pressure, yeah, that can really help raise your metabolic rate to a point where you can actually crawl out of bed. Yeah. Low blood pressure will make you live longer, right? I'm not that kind of doctor. But you can lower your metabolic rate, so the quote that you would live longer, but really the goal all of us should have in life is maximizing the number of heartbeats or maximizing the amount of activity we can perform in our life. So it's not necessarily a great idea to try to lower your metabolic rate to the point where all you do is sleep all day. I mean, what kind of life is that? Yeah, well, we need to... Well, if you live long enough, it will happen. Those of us that are older can tell you it's a guarantee, all right? There's something about thermodynamics that does that. Okay, let's get into our lesson here. Okay. I'm going to just jump right through our lesson I've recorded here. By the way, I'm going to need to jerry-rig this thing. There we go. one way to stop this thing from going down. That's what they taught us in physics, to always be resourceful. Okay, but this thing's rotating now, and I don't think I'm going to win. Oh, that's true. People didn't face these kinds of challenges, and all they had was blackboards. So, that's true. Okay. As I mentioned, this is all covered in our book here. This is a debate on whether or not general revelation is reliable. Is the Bible the only reliable source of truth, or do we actually get a reliable, trustworthy, inerrant message through the record of nature? These are some verses about God can't lie. Belgic Confession makes the point that God indeed has given us a trustworthy revelation through the record of nature that is akin to an actual book with words and sentences and paragraphs. And a little definition of the difference between science and theology and the Bible and the record of nature. Science and theology involve interpretation. The words of the Bible and the record of nature are indeed this perfect revelation from the Creator. I won't go through these International Council biblical inerrancy statements. We've done this twice before. But it's a major source of the debate over whether or not there is an accurate revelation in nature. And these are some of the verses that deal with general revelation, the ones I want us to actually study. But mentioned previously, this is not a complete list of all the verses in the Bible that talk about general revelation. For example, I don't include anything from Proverbs, and a good chunk of Proverbs is an exhortation to look to nature in order to learn how to live your lives. But these are verses that tell us some specific doctrinal points about what general revelation can do and cannot do. And we've been through the first of these, so I'm going to kind of rapidly go through it. Ask the animals, and they'll teach you, or the birds of the air, and they'll tell you, or speak to the earth, and they'll teach you, or let the fish of the sea inform you. And we spent some time when we were looking at Job 39. Job 39 is a creation text that actually informs us of how God has created certain animals in order to teach us lessons about how we can come into a relationship with Him, particularly through the soulish animals, the birds and the mammals. So there is something that we can gain from studying the animals. In that sense, looking at these nature channels, that does have a benefit, although I would warn you, it's not quite as distortion-free as when you actually look at what goes on for yourself when you're out there in the world of nature. So visiting some of these wild animal parks does have a benefit. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is man that you're mindful of him? This is the last creation text we studied, and the whole point of Psalm 8 is that creation teaches us to be humble. And why is that so important? Well, there's a verse in the New Testament that tells us that God gives grace to the humble and resists the proud. And so nature has been designed by God to show us the pathway to humility. And as we looked in Psalm 8, we discovered four different ways God uses creation to teach us that the pathway to Him is through humility. God designed creation to show us that humility. I think we had quite a fun time discussing how God uses little children as a way to teach us lessons about humility, and how that maybe explains why certain nations are more resistant to the Christian faith than other nations. You can almost draw a correlation between how many little children exist in the population and how receptive that population is to the Christian faith. And Psalm 8 tells us that little children are an important part of that. The stars, the sun, and the moon are also an important part of that when we recognize just how insignificant we are. By the way, one of you asked me a question last week about the fine-tuning of the mass of the universe, and I went back home and thought about it a little bit. And I think I've come up with an analogy that any one of you can use to explain the supernatural design in the mass of the universe. I mean, Psalm 8 makes the point that this whole universe was created by God on our behalf. He created this universe for many reasons, but one reason was to give us a home in which we can live. Now, the mass of the universe, the Hubble Deep Field, and the Hubble Ultra Deep Field is the first slide I showed you, and almost everything in that field was galaxies. And that's the deepest field taken to date, and it shows us that the observable universe contains 50 billion trillion stars. So we now have a number of how many stars exist in the universe that we're actually potentially able to observe, 50 billion trillion. Now those 50 billion trillion stars make up 1% of the total mass of the universe. So you've got to multiply that by another factor of 100 to get the total mass of the universe. And I've told you before that if you were to change the mass of the universe by one part in a quadrillion, 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 there'd be no possibility for physical life to exist anytime, anywhere in the universe. Now, that's a mind-boggling big number, but I've been able to come up with an analogy I think will help you understand what it all means. Okay, we live in a universe of 50 billion trillion stars, and those 50 billion trillion stars make up 1% of the universe. Okay, if you were to add one dime to the total mass of the universe, or take away one dime from the total mass in the observable universe, that would be enough to make life impossible anytime, anywhere in the universe. That's how sensitive the balance is. So hopefully that's an analogy that various ones of you can use when you're talking to people. We know that the universe must be supernaturally designed because of how extremely sensitive the mass of the universe must be to make life possible here on planet Earth. Yes. Well, you can work that out, too. I haven't done that for you. But you can take... By the way, when I say a dime, I'm being conservative. Actually, a tenth of a dime is enough to disturb the balance. But, you know, a dime is a nice, easy thing for people to get a visual picture of. No, that's mass right now. Okay, yeah. We're talking about the total mass of the universe, and yeah, you can convert some of that mass into energy, but what we're really talking about is the sum total of what you could call matter-gy. Now, mass and heat energy, because in addition to that, we've got this dark energy. And dark energy is independent of this. We're not talking dark energy, we're talking matter and the energy you could get from matter. And so, you know, like stars are turning matter into energy, but there's also places where it's going the other way around, where energy is being converted into matter. Yes. Yes, the universe gets colder and colder as it gets older and older. We will. If you wait long enough, everything will twinkle out. No. In fact, no matter how much the universe expands, it will not disturb the sum total of mass and energy. That will remain a constant. It's because of the expansion, right? Right, right. So, yeah, the first law of thermodynamics still holds. The sum total of matter and energy remains a constant. But if you were to take what you begin with and add a dime to it or subtract a dime away from it, that's enough to disturb the balance. No, we can't do that. It is a constant. Yeah. It really does kill time travel, yeah. Yeah. Right. Can't do that either. No. Yes. But yeah, you can use that in your witnessing. Yeah. A dime is enough to disturb the balance, yes. Antimatter has no effect on the balance because, you know, you can take matter, bring it close to antimatter, turn into energy. What we're talking is the conservation, the total sum of all the matter and heat energy in the universe. That is a constant. So if you convert from one to the other, that doesn't disturb the total mass budget of the universe or the total energy budget of the universe. So that's why some scientists have coined this term matter-gy. Because of the fact that we can convert matter into energy, energy into matter, but the sum total of all the matter and energy must remain a constant. Now, again, for accepting dark energy, because dark energy is a different form of energy. And dark energy is something that is independent of all this other stuff. By the way, the dark energy has to be tuned to an even greater degree. It's just that I can't come up with a dime analogy that works for dark energy. So, okay, moving on. So, Psalm 8 is a message of humility. And Psalm 19, which generated this study, is where the Belgic Confession comes up with its doctrine that indeed the record of nature is a second book. God has given us two books. The Bible, which is actual words, paragraphs, and sentences, but he's also given us the record of nature, which you see in Psalm 19. They use the analogy speech, language, and words. So it speaks to us just like the Bible would speak to us. It speaks to us through words. So when you see this phrase, the word of the Lord, based on Psalm 19, that's not just the Bible. That would be the word that's spoken to our heart on our conscience, is also the word that's spoken to us through the record of nature. So this is where the Belgic confessors actually got their doctrinal point, that there is this second book, this book of creation, where each creature is like a letter or a word, making up sentences in the language that's spoken to all the peoples of the earth. The word of the Lord is right and true. He is faithful in all he does. This will be the next creation text we study after we get through Psalm 19. And this is a statement that all of God's revelation is right. So I mentioned to you before when I had this debate with Ken Ham in last January on television, he was trying to analyze Psalm 19 with the idea that the Bible is right and true and faithful, but not the record of nature. Because it doesn't use the words right and true with the record of nature he claimed. However, what we notice here is that the word of the Lord is not just the words of the Bible, it's also the words spoken through the record of nature. So in that sense, I would interpret Psalm 19 as saying that all of God's word is right, true, and faithful. And this is what Psalm 33, I think, makes quite clear. The word of the Lord is right and true. He is faithful in all he does. So he is faithful not only in his revelation through the words of the Bible, he is faithful in his revelation as well through the record of nature, and for that matter, to what he puts on our heart, the law that he has written upon our heart. And I noticed that Ken Ham in the debate was trying to claim that the law of the Lord was limited to the words of the Bible, but we're going to come up with a verse in Romans which tells us that God has written his law upon our hearts, the conscience. And so in that sense, we'd have to conclude that the law is not limited to just the words of the Bible. Yes. Right. Yes. You can't claim that that's limited to just the Bible. Right. So, I don't know how well that came across in the debate because we had to change subjects so quickly, but you know, we have an opportunity here to study it in more depth. Okay, moving on. This is, I think, where we left off last week, this particular verse. And now we're moving into actually new territory with 5, 8, and 10 minutes to go. All right. The heavens proclaim his righteousness. And the point here is many verses in the Bible talk about how the heavens proclaim the glory of God. You see that in Psalm 19. Psalm 50, as well as Psalm 97, makes the point that the heavens proclaim the righteousness of God. And the point here is that creation reveals more than simply the existence of God. That was part of the debate as well, where I noticed that the answers in Genesis folks were trying to claim that the creation is only effective in revealing that there is a God out there. But this is a verse that tells us that the study of the heavens reveals more than just simply that God exists. It tells us something about his character, and for that matter, his plan of salvation. When the heavens proclaim his righteousness, I interpret that God is using the heavens to tell us how we can gain the righteousness of God. So it's a hint that there's something in there that actually reveals not just God's existence, but his plan for humanity. Okay. They who dwell in the ends of the earth stand in awe of your signs. Now, I made a comment last week. I was going to make you do the work, and I notice I'm doing all the work here. So I'm going to stop at this point and just ask you the question, what insight can we gain about natural revelation from this verse in Psalm 65, verse 8? Those who dwell in the ends of the earth stand in awe of your signs. Especially like to hear from those of you that have been on the mission field, what your experience has been when you've been to the ends of the earth and how people respond. Any comments? All right. That's close to the ends of the earth, yes. Right. Right. Well, thank you. I mean, this is the point you see in Psalm 65. What the psalmist is doing is contrasting the response of the Jews to the response of people at the ends of the earth. Yeah, any comment? And the stars. Yeah, interesting. So, but was your experience similar in the sense that people, say, living in Bolivia are much more likely to say there's got to be a God than, say, people living in Los Angeles? Yeah. Right. So that's why people like to have Japanese gardeners. All right. Take care of the backyard. But I think the point is clear, and this is brought out in Psalm 65, that it's those people that are closest to the revealed revelation of Scripture that often struggle most with this idea that there's a God out there that has a plan for their lives and wishes to form a relationship with Him. Whereas people living far away from any church or Christian community or an abundance of Bibles, they tend not to struggle to the same degree that people, say, in the industrialized, Christianized West would with the idea, is there a God out there? I mean, what I'm hearing from these missionaries here, when you're in a spot like that, they say, well, of course there is a God. Tell me about this God. Yes. Right. Right. Well, I think Mongolia is an interesting situation, too, because I've been to Mongolia as well. And when you fly over Mongolia, there's no roads. You don't see any telephone wires going over the country. I mean, it's just, it looks like it was 2,000 years ago. And in that sense, I think the population there is much closer to nature than we are. I mean, we're insulated by all these skyscrapers and freeways and automobiles and high technology. They seem to be delivered from that. But the one thing I observed, I was kind of in Ulaanbaatar. But we had an event where we invited all the professors and the high school teachers. They all came. I mean, that would never happen in America, where you invite all the professors to come to an event and they all show up, where they know ahead of time it's a Christian event. But in Mongolia, they all came. And it's the first time I've ever been able to talk to all the teachers in the nation at one time. Now, part of that is the fact that it's got such a low population. There's only 3 million people in the country, and there aren't that many teachers. In fact, I think there were like 800. So 800 teachers made up the whole population, whereas that's probably just the number of teachers in one city here in the Los Angeles Basin. Yes. How about that? Right. Well, I think the point here is clear, is that often it's people who don't have all the revelation that are most receptive to what God reveals through the record of nature. So record of nature seems to speak more powerfully when people don't have access to the things that we have. Or maybe it's the fact that they're simply humbler than we are. I mean, the message of Psalm 8, that humility is a way that you gain revelation from God. You know, as I read Scripture, the more we can respond to God with humility, the more He will guarantee that we get the revelation that we need. And whereas if we're proud, then the revelation we have will be taken away from us. In the back. I'll get to you next. Well, where I'm leading you with this study is that nature is a powerful revelation of the existence of God, the character of God, and even the outline of the plan of salvation. But it does not give you the details of the plan of salvation. That is limited to special revelation. Likewise, we're going to see that God has given us a revelation in our conscience. And it kind of gives us the basic outlines. But there's nothing written on our hearts that tells us that there was a man that died on the cross for us 2,000 years ago, or that the Holy Spirit can permanently indwell our lives if we give our lives up to Him. And so the details are missing. Well, what we're going to see is that if indeed you have this humble response, you can put the whole package together. The problem is, and that was, you know, Job and Elihu. How many of us have the humility of Job and Elihu? I would argue it's probably less than a millionth of a percent, which means we're going to need missionaries to go out there, because most of us are not in that category of Job and Elihu. We're not Daniel. And because we're not in that category, we do need this additional revelation. And what missiologists tell us is that the average human being needs to hear the plan of salvation 8 different times in 8 different ways through 8 different modes before they're going to come to faith in Christ. A few will respond to one. You know, a Job, it took one. Most of us, it takes several. And for some of us, it takes dozens. And, you know, we're now thousands of years after Jesus died on the cross. In one sense, the people who are most receptive, we've done a fairly good job of reaching them. we need to think seriously about reaching those people that need to hear it six different ways, or reaching those people that need to hear it 16 different ways, and from 16 different kinds of people and different means of communication, books or whatever. That's kind of what it's like here in the United States. I know very few people here in the United States that respond to just one revelation message. Most of them need to hear it several different ways. I'm in that category. I had to hear it many different ways before it really brought home to me what was going on. Okay. You? Yeah, then we're going to close. Yeah. Well, that's kind of where I'm trying to take you through is these creation texts we're studying, is that certain messages are going to get through to people living in Germany as opposed to people living in Mongolia. There's a reason why God has given us so many different revelations and so many different evangelistic tools. Some tools work well in one context, other tools work well in a different context. But most people need to hear several. So what I tell people is, don't just assume because somebody has no science education, they won't be impressed with a dark energy argument for the existence of God. You'd be amazed. You give it to someone who has no background in science at all, and they latch onto it, and it becomes a turning point in their lives. And the whole point is, we don't know what the Holy Spirit's doing in that person's life. And so the best tactic is to come equipped with multiple tools. And if one doesn't work, try something else. And if people aren't listening to your testimony, they need to pray that God will send someone to them that they will respond to. I had to do that with my parents. I realized they weren't listening to me. So I began to pray that God would bring Christians into their lives that were in their age bracket. And God honored the prayer. That planted a seed and opened up the door for me to come back and share with them. And by the way, the turning point for my mother wasn't anything I said. I sent her a video. And it was a video from our TV show. My dad called me and says, "Your mother couldn't interrupt you." And it works. It was funny. You know, what my mother said to my dad was, "Why didn't Hugh tell me that 30 years ago?" And his response is, "Because you wouldn't let him." But often that's the way it works in families. You know, just like parents struggle to get the message across to their kids and their grandkids, it works, you know, both ways. And that's the whole point. It usually takes several people working from different perspectives with different evangelistic tools to get the job done. But in places like Mongolia, it's a lot easier. One of the easiest places I've found to share the faith is places where the population is almost 100% Hindu. And you say, why there? Because all these Hindus know that the religion they've been given to them by their parents and their culture, they know there's something wrong. They can't put their finger on it, but they know there's something wrong, and they're eager to find out what that is.